This is the Lansing Fisher Body Historical Team. Today we're here to interview Richard L. Sanborn. Richard C. Sanborn. Today is April 26th. We're in the local 602 conference room, and the time is approximately 10:30 a.m. First, we'll introduce the team.
Cheryl McQuaid.
John Fedewa.
Jerry Smith.
And I'm Doug Rademacher. Today, again, we're interviewing Mr. Sanborn. Will you please state your name and spell it for us?
Richard C. Sanborn, R-I-C-H-A-R-D-C-S-A-N-D-B-O-R-N.
And what is your address?
3653 East Grand River, Portland, Michigan, 48875.
Are you married?
Yes.
Do you have children?
Yes. Four.
Four. Okay.
Two boys, two girls.
Where were you born and raised?
I was born a half mile where I live right now, in my mother's house, and dad's house.
And that
was raised there.
Portland?
In Portland, Michigan.
And
four miles west of Portland, Michigan, on East Grand River Avenue.
And would you tell me, what did your parents do for a living?
Farmers. Farmer and my wife, or boy. My mother was a homemaker. She raised 13 kids. Six brothers, six sisters.
And you're 13?
13. I was the middle one. Okay. Six older and six younger.
What is your education level?
High school in Portland.
Richard, were you ever in the military?
No, I wasn't. I was going to go when a buddy of mine was going to go to, then we got down to, this is during the Korean War, we got down to Detroit, ready to take our physical, and he got notice his dad had a heart attack. Well, he wouldn't go, so I wouldn't go. I come back, which I'm probably maybe lucky, you know. I might not be here.
Well, we're lucky to have you here today, that's for sure. You said your parents were farmers. What did you do before you hired into Fisher Body?
Worked on a farm for CWNF farm, they called it. He was a big shot in General Motors. In fact, he built a CWNF school out here in Grand Ledge. It was named after him and everything. And worked there for 3 years. And if I remember right, I got $100 a month plus my milk and butter, meat. That was working. In the morning, we was milking 50 head of cows till night, every day, 7 days a week, for my brother, who owned, kind of managed the farm.
And did you live on this farm, or did you still?
Yeah, we lived on the farm. In that time, I weighed 134 pounds, and I wore the same shoes to church and stuff that we wore in the barn.
And what duties?
That's how rough it was, yeah.
What duties did you do on a farm? Did you take turns covering different duties, or was it the same one all the time?
No, we'd run the milk and Guernsey cows. We had a whole herd of them, 50 of them. And the guy, like I said, he was a big General Motors executive, so he'd come out every morning. He'd check the barn out. We had to put lime down. We had to clean the barn, the stables, everything had to be white. Everything had to be white. And then he'd go and check where we had the milkers with his hands and stuff, make sure everything was clean.
And you say he was with the General Motors. Was he at our Fisher facility?
No,
or was
he started out in Buffalo, New York. He designed a Buffalo plant in Buffalo, New York. He helped invent the, I think it was what they called the valve lifters at that time. He was one of the inventors of that. He drew a heavy royalties, you know, a lot of money from GM, so that's why he could afford to donate that school up.
Hmm. Interesting.
It's still, I think it's still out in Grand Ledge, as far as I know. I don't know if it's still named the CWNF school, but it was.
Okay. Would you please tell us, why did you hire into Fisher Body?
No. Can I say something more before
Say anything you'd like.
After that, I went to Real to work, Real Motors. And I worked down there for 2 years in the lawnmower division. On a piecework, welding hubs and lawnmowers. Of course, they had the truck plant and stuff, their motor plant. And they went on strike. And I had three little kids. My wife and I had three little kids at home, and I couldn't afford a strike very long. And all they give us, there's no benefits. You know, no strike benefits. They give you some donuts and some apple cider, and that was it. So I left there and went, come into Fisher Body. Because I couldn't. I'm lucky I did make the change, you know, because I'd had retired along with a lot of them other guys who had didn't get a lot of benefits. They're real.
No, that didn't end
or
up.
Lost being. Them later, I guess, anyway. From under.
So you talk about the strike. Can you tell us, when did you hire into Fisher Body?
5:15 to 55.
How did you know they were hiring?
I think they had, if I remember, I think they had notices out that they needed help then. They were hired a lot of people in late 54 and 55.
Do you have any other family members that worked at Fisher Body?
I have a son-in-law who works there, Dave Fisher, in the paint department. And I had my youngest son, who's now retired athletic director from Flint, football coach, football and track coach. He worked there for 2 days in the trim department. And somebody found out that he was my son, now he's president of the union. I guess didn't like him or something for some reason. Slung a motor down the line, you know, on the trails, hit him side the head. When they knocked him out, he quit after 2 days.
Oh, my.
You know, there was things going on then that if they got wind of who you were, some people didn't care much for the union, you know.
Well, that sounds like some story we're going to have to hear about. Cheryl McQuaid?
What year was that when your son hired in?
I would think around 72 somewhere. Because he's out of school teaching now, 30, yeah. I think it'd be 71, 72 in there. I couldn't say for sure on that. Cause
okay, well, how old were you when you hired into the Fisher plant?
I'm 75 now, and I hired in 55. I was born in 31, would make me
31,
24.
Okay. Well,
I mean, the first, actually, get back to when the first job I ever had wasn't really on the field. I worked on a tiling machine, laying tile for Wellwater and Christensen, where they farm tile around the different areas and stuff, you know. And there was another deal there. Somebody looked over at me because we were laying tile, and I was what you call riding a shoe behind, you know. And we could only lay 8-inch tile, and we had 10-inch we had to lay that day. So I had to lay it outside the shoe, what they call a shoe, that's the trench, you know. And I was laying outside, and all of a sudden, the banks come in on me. And God or somebody looked over at me, because I happened to be standing up when it happened. And it caught me right up to here. And there's only two guys there. Only one of them had a shovel, but that was switching a spade. And they started digging, and the guy that had them running the machine, he told me, he says, don't move. Don't try to breathe. Just breathe, you know, but don't try to get yourself out because get more pressure on you. And I survived it all right. But if I'd been bent over, I'd been dead. Simple. You know, you don't know when your time is. They never laid tile outside that shoe again after that. Even if they banked the wall up, they still wouldn't do that.
You call it a shoe or a chute?
Shoe. A shoe. They call it a shoe. You ride, because your feet are on the bottom. You ride backwards. You kick the tile together with your shoe, see, so that's why they call it a shoe. It's 4 foot, you know, 3-4 foot deep down in the ground and stuff.
Okay.
That was for 75 cents an hour.
What shift and department did you hire into?
Body shop. And I worked in solder wheel. I think they called it 4C, group 4C. Metal finish area, it was 4B. I think solder was 4C. Just beyond where they put the solder on it, and then we grind it off, you know.
And you were you fortunate to have the first shift or second shift?
Swing shift.
What does that mean?
We all dreaded that. you worked 4 weeks days, 4 weeks nights. And then they voted one time to extend it to 5 weeks days, 5 weeks nights. Then they voted out. That was always a political issue with everybody, you know, too. You had your older seniority people who naturally wanted to stay on days. You know, and you had your younger seniority people who felt that wasn't fair because they had worked straight, you know, they'd have to work straight nights, so that's why you had the swing shift. They'd get more, the night shift would get more voters out, you know, so they just voted for the swing shift.
Well,
that's quite a few years, too.
So it all went back to...
Until it started to run in, you know, you run into a lot of problems, family problems and stuff. People have to swing. You had a lot of more people getting sick and stuff because your environment's different, you know, when you swing shifts or when they're a week or so. So then they went back to straight shifts.
Hmm. And do you remember which year that was that they voted in the straight shifts?
I think Joe Santora was president, if I remember right.
Okay. Well, I'm going to get a little nostalgic on you. I want you to think back. How was it to get an application at that time? Did you have to stand in line, or was there a different method?
You go right in and get an application. Easy. No problem at all. You didn't have to be referred by your brother or dad or anybody, you know. Went in and got in there, and then a week later they'd call you, or maybe sometimes hire you the same day. You'd be interviewed. They had some people who were pretty good, others management people there. We're number one, you know, bad guys.
Well, will you share with us your first day? Can you remember walking in the doors of Fisher Body? You said you came from a Rio lawnmower line, so you'd done a little assembly work. What was it like to walk in and see an auto assembly plant? And what was your first day like?
Scared. You know, I was a farm boy. All been more or less born a farm boy all my life, you know. I was petrified. I didn't know whether I could find a department. Didn't know where, if I'd find my way back to the vehicle or not, in the parking lot. It was bad. And then once I got on the job, and of course, I was assigned to the body shop to grind solder. Where do you think I went? Trim departments. They put me up there. And kept me on different type of jobs up trim department probably for, I don't know, 2 weeks. And there was a solid body shop for about 2 weeks. Then they finally moved. When they had enough help up there I was filling in kind of, you know, me and other guys, you know. When they got enough help, then they put me back down the booth. Wearing a hood, which I got on the day I retired. I got it right home in my basement. They give me. The Labor Relations Department gave it to me because I was a high committee man at that time, you know, and past president local, so they felt they owed me something. I didn't know they was going to do it. They did.
Well, early on then, you hired in the body, but they put you right up into trim? Or did you work one day in the body?
No, I never worked at all.
So you were taken up a supervisor, or how'd they pick you to take you to trim?
They just told me when I got, I reported on the body shop.
Mm-hmm.
Then they just, the supervisor took me up there. Hell, I couldn't find my way up there. You know, I didn't know where to go. And I was up there. They had me report up there, same foreman for a while. Then he would loan me out, the foreman up there, to other areas within the trim department. I don't remember whether it was A and B line, which one line was on for sure. I know I was up there. I dreaded it.
So the
because I wanted a regular job, you know.
Uh-huh.
I didn't want to be stuck all over the place.
But you got to see the trim department. Different people view the different areas of the plant. There's a body, paint, and trim. You got to see trim. Then they took you to body shop. Can you tell me the first day of going down to body shop?
Yeah, I went down there, and I think Bill McGuffney was my supervisor. And John McGinley was the superintendent down the bottom. He was a hell of a nice guy. The reason I'm saying that, I got to know him. You don't mind me saying hell to you?
No, say anything you want. Everything, this is... Just a piece of history.
Because I did a lot of negotiating with him, see, when I was chairman of the shop committee for one term over there. I negotiated with him. And then when I was president for 9 years, I did a lot of negotiating with him, too. So you get to know a lot of the higher-ups, you know, plant managers, the superintendents.
Can you tell me how the job differed, though? The body shop job that you got put on, what was that like? You said you put a hood on, but you worked up in trim.
Yeah, well, I felt more relaxed and enjoyed it more, even though I had a hood over my head. I was on the B line, which pumps air. I don't know if you're familiar with what the body shop used to be like, whether it's anything like that today or not. Pumped air into your face so you could breathe, you know. And we had cotton batten for earplugs. And then we got gloves. Should have got them every 2 or 3 days, but a lot of times if you get a hole in your glove, you'd ask for new gloves. The supervisor would bring you a roll of tape. You take off a chunk and you tape it up and continue your job. And then I worked in the booth with water underneath me. A pit. There's a pit underneath. It was a pit full of water, though, you know. I couldn't stay under. So I had to squat because I was grinding the rockers on them. What they call the rocker panels, all the way across there. And after I did that for about a year, I'm getting ahead of myself, but after I did it for about a year, I had a hernia. And I had to go on sick leave on account of that. And they had two other guys had hernias too. So they finally decided they could lower that. You know, their smart engineers decided they could lower that level where you wouldn't have to squat every time at 62 cars an hour, you know, squat down and up, up and down. Not only on the front part of the rocker, but in the middle and the rear, three times you had to squat. They lowered that pit, and then all we had to do was right in front of us, you know, and they lowered the water level. They waited to three guys had a hernia, which I filed, by the way, I had worked in Wisconsin.
Yeah, I heard you say sick leave, and I was going to ask you that, so it was deemed work-related, and you were able to collect workers' comp?
Yeah. Now, I should have. I did one other thing. I should have had these all taken care of, too. I should have filed workman's comp, and I didn't do that. I regret it right now because it's costing me $700 every so often to get a new hearing aid.
As I say, you said
but
these.
If I had workman's comp, it would be paid for it right today.
He's pointing to his ears. So speaking of the hearing aid he's wearing, definitely work-related, huh?
Yeah, I guess it was that ringing.
Cheryl McQuaid?
You said you were grinding the solder. Mm-hmm. How big was the machine you had to squat up and down with? Was it on a pulley?
It was on a pulley, overhead pulley. It developed, I think, 30,000 RPMs or something. Electrical machine. You know, the machine was run off electrical. And then big grinder, you pull it down. Grind your spot off, you know, and then release it back up and then pull it back down for the next part. Of course, when you grind lead, I was grinding lead, and I got lead poisoning. That's one of my problems I still get living with right today with my kidneys. I got taken out of the booth 3 different times on account of lead poisoning. And I got taken out a couple times because I knew how to shaft them, you know. I knew how to get high lead when I didn't have high lead.
And did they have you medically checked for lead?
Oh, yes. We had coveralls in two that had one pocket here, you know, that's it. And it clipped over, you know, you only had one pocket, one of the pockets on it. And back in them days, when everybody smoked, you know. Well, we couldn't get anybody a lot of times to relieve us or stuff, so we'd carry our cigarettes inside of here. And then when the line was stopped for an instant, we'd light up, pull our hood off because there was no lead flying, you know, and light up. Well, them cigarettes, over a period of time or years, you know, they had a little bit of lead on them, you know. And that one of the reasons why we got some lead poisoning out of them. But sometimes we couldn't get nobody to relieve us. We'd do things that actually you should get fired for. If we got caught doing them, we'd get fired. But you couldn't get a, you know, somebody to relieve you. We was on a curve. Just before they come to a curve, we stick to these rag wheels in the line, We call them rag wheels. The grinding wheel, you know, about this big around, like an emery stuff.
About 3 inches around?
Yeah. And when the jobs would come around the corner, it would trip the dog, what they called the dog on it, you know, that little clip deal, and they come together. Well, that meant skilled trades had to come out there and and do some work, you know, it'd take about 10 minutes, so we'd get our relief that way. We had different guys assigned within the booth would pull us all the time, so they couldn't catch us, because they'd even have a supervisor outside trying to watch it and see what was causing it. But we was one step ahead of them.
So that would afford you a little bit of breakdown time so that you could run to the bathroom or have a cigarette. How did you fudge it so
We had people who didn't have time to go to the bathroom. I've seen where they took a leak right there, right down in the water, because it wouldn't get a guy in there. They might wait 15, 20 minutes, nobody come in. There'd be guys standing out there with the foreman, but usually the relief man was the foreman's pet or something, you know, normally, back in them days. He'd go in whenever he damn felt like it, you know.
So teacher's pet isn't just school, they had it in the plant too.
You bet they did, yeah.
Now, you said that you could fudge your lead levels. How would you do that? So it looked like
coffee,
you had...
Coffee put it up higher.
Really?
It was always high anyway, you know, fairly high from working in the environment. But we found out coffee... We had a Dr. Oshner was our doctor there. He was there for, God, I don't know, probably 30 years. And they had a nurse there. Joe Birch, who ended up superintendent, superintendent of the body shop. That was, nurse was his wife and stuff. He knew about some of the stuff that was going on, but he never said anything because he was a good guy, Joe was. You know, some of your supervisors would be good guys, they'd work with you and try to help you with others. Probably the same way nowadays.
So if your lead was high, what did they do to get it lower?
They kept your rate of pay the same, but sent you back in the jungle, in the body shop.
Out of the lead booth, but in the jungle.
And jobs where you really worked your butt off, too.
So you were kind of disciplined for having high lead. They gave you an undesirable job?
Oh, yeah, you got the most undesirable job. You didn't get an offline job. They had offline spot welders, too, but they stick you right in the line. The one I got was for a supervisor, Ray Robson, at that time. And does all right to get in on some of this?
Oh, yeah, sure.
And I was where they dropped what they called the floor pan under the, where the line first started, you know, under the frame itself there. I'd have to get up in the trunk of the car. I mean, step off the step, get up in the trunk, weld around the rear window, get back down off, run around to the front, weld across the front. I mean, there's nobody wanted the job, you know. They'd stick you on that. They figured that would get you over, make sure you'd correct your lead problem, you know, quicker. You wouldn't fake it and stuff, you know what I mean?
And you did that 60-plus times an hour.
Oh, yeah. And that, once again, I'd wear gloves out. Every day I'd have gloves to be worn out. I'd ask for a new pair of gloves. Once again, I'd get that black tape. Harold Teft was a foreman back there. They called him Cowboy. He was a terrible guy. And they had another guy. Don Clark was supervisor back there, off point spot. Well, he was a real nice guy. Everybody liked it. His family lives out here in Grand Ledge, I think.
Now, when you had to do around the back window and then run around the front of the car and do the front windshield area, was that spot welding or MIG welding?
Spot welding. The gun. You had to pull that heavy gun down, you know. Well, no light gun. You had to pull it down, and you had to have them spot. No, you know, not that far, but they'd be just what they want so far apart. You had to move with it. If you goofed a little bit, got them too far apart or not far, not close enough, then they'd get after you.
I can't even imagine you had enough time to do all
you
that.
You sweat it. You sweat. Like I say, I weighed 135 pounds. You know.
And then you were hopping up and down off the car.
Yeah, off that flatbed, you know, that the body rides on, yeah. And then getting into the trunk, which is greasy and slippery and everything else, you know.
And raw metal.
Yeah.
Sounds like a nightmare.
That was something, if you didn't really need the money and stuff, you'd quit maybe. Yeah. But if you got four kids and stuff and need the money, I had to have it, you know. It wasn't something I wanted to make a career out to start out with.
And how long would you have to do that type of work, that type of job, before they would allow you back into the booth?
Well, they usually keep you out like, 2 weeks or so. Then they run you down to the hospital for another check. They take blood out of you. And your level would normally be back down, and they'd put you back on your old job. You always got your old job back. Always give you the old job.
Doug Rademacher, you said the jungle, and you worked, it was hard work. Who worked in the jungle regularly, and who taught you how to do those jobs? And can you describe what a jungle means? What does it look like?
It just looked like a lot of heavy machines and stuff, sparks flying all over the place, you know. And welding, it was, you said MIG welding. Well, this is more or less just plain welding back then, and a lot of people had problems with their eyes over that, you know, the welding deal, because they didn't provide the proper shields and stuff for you, you know. And it was made up of, I would say, probably two-thirds of them were black people that was back there, minority people that were in that area. And some of it was whites, but most of it was people like myself who had lead poisoning, or some people, they just wanted to shaft around, move them around the body shop.
And you said you worked up in trim. Were the minorities, Hispanics, blacks, were they kept in particular areas, or did you see them in trim?
No, I never even noticed them up there in trim much. There was some up there, but I never happened to notice them. No.
Cheryl McQuaid.
You mentioned that when you first hired in, you were assigned body shop, but you worked in trim for a couple of weeks, and you hated it. What was it about trim that you didn't like, other than it not being your regular job? Were the jobs hard?
Yeah, the jobs were hard. I just couldn't, for some reason, I couldn't keep up and do the things they had me doing. Reaching my hand in over a sharp metal or something, you know, to put a piece of trim on or something. I just couldn't do it right. Catching hell all the time from supervisors, and I just didn't. And different job every day, number one. Not the same job 2 days in a row. And that, when I leave home, I didn't know what I was going to do. And that alone kind of petrifies you, you know, because you don't know whether you're going to be able to. I always wanted to do my fair day's work, you know, and do a good job, but I just couldn't do it up there.
And was that the norm, to put somebody on a different job every day? Doesn't it take a while to learn a job? Or?
Well, I don't think it was normal, but they did it with a lot of people, though, you know.
Doug Rademacher. Richard, you said you came from Portland. Can you tell me what it was like to drive back in the 50s, the 20, 30 miles one way to get to General Motors, the Fisher plant?
Well, when we was on the night shift, it was a lot of fun.
And why is that?
When we got out of work.
Oh.
Usually it is, we'd take turns, three or four of us ride together. A guy by the name of Hitchcock, Galanitis, we'd take turns driving back and forth. We'd come down, of course, Saginaw had nothing then. We'd come down to Waverly and Saginaw, like down to Fisher, and no problem at all. The only problem might be with your jet plant and some of them getting down and out of work, but there was no businesses out there then. That was all farmland. Basically all the way to Grand Ledge. And then after we get out of work, sometime 2 o'clock, we knew we had going to work 9-10 hours, which would be 3. And you call the, right by, it used to be airport, where the Elks Club out there, by the airport?
Yep, it's still there.
Is it? But it used to be an airport bar, wasn't it?
Airport Tavern still.
Airport Tavern, yeah, okay. We'd call out there and order our refreshments, and then he'd have him waiting for us. And he had a dog by the name of Bonnie, I remember. When we get out regular hours, we'd stop and see him. We run into a lot of different people there. And I remember one night we run into a guy that invited us over to his house. we got over there, and he was Governor G. Men Williams' pilot. And he had all kinds of food for us in his basement and had a real blast for us, all the beer and whiskey we wanted to drink. This is 3 o'clock in the morning. But he was just welcoming, you know, working people, see. Of course, he was, in my opinion, he was one of our best governors we ever had, G. Men Williams, for the working man.
Well, we definitely need that.
We're inheriting right now all the stuff that John Engler screwed up for years.
Definitely got our hands full right now trying to keep every job we've got.
Yeah.
Did you hire in by yourself or did you hire in with a group of people?
Well, I hired kind of by myself. Okay. There was people hired in, you know, a week or two ahead of me, but I hired in that same day and stuff by myself.
When you first started, were there new hire initiations or pranks that were played on the worker back then?
No, I don't. Not really. Of course, they couldn't play. Well, sometimes in the booth they could play pranks, like shut your air off, you know, put a piece of wire or something, so you couldn't breathe for a while. Find out what it was and have to take the wire off. Or yeah, and also some of the metal finishers worked beyond us. Thought we wasn't grinding enough solder off. So when we would take our break, they would take our little hose that goes into our hood. They put some water in that damn thing. And then so when we plugged it into the air, you know what we got? A little bit of inside of our face shield. You see, we had a shield, you know, in front of it. That was all wet. We'd have to have a rag and wipe it all off so we could see to work. That happened different times.
Okay.
Or sometimes we would put stuff on the seam after we got done, too, to make sure that it would kind of mess it up for the metal finisher, too. Like black rubber gold or something. Now they had some pranks.
I think the word is paybacks or hell, right?
Yeah. Right.
You've shared some of the places you've worked and some of the things that you had to, they gave you to wear as far as protective equipment and so forth. What was the environment when you hired in and did you see it change over the years as you worked?
What do you mean, the environment?
The work environment. Yeah, you said you had cotton for your ears. When did you see changes?
They're probably, I'd say probably 61, somewhere in there, before they started giving us earplug.
And did you get the gloves instead of tape at that
time? Yeah, I think it was about then when we negotiated the gloves for us, yeah, in that area. Where we had to buy our own gloves to start out with. Negotiated gloves for everybody and extra pairs and stuff. Committee them.
Well, how did they do that? How did you pay for it? Out of your paycheck? Was it deducted or did you have to pay?
I don't have some listing in there for, you know, so much for your coveralls, for one pair of coveralls a week. Or if you worked in the booth, you had to change them every day. But they still only charge you for one pair. But they did give you the other four pair if you worked 5 days. Of course, then was 10 and 11, 5 nights and days. A lot of that was overtime.
Now, this was good money.
Oh, yeah. $1.75 an hour. That was it. Paid a lot of overtime. Then come to 19, I think I was 58. I was laid off for 1 year. They didn't sell cars at all. 57 and 58 didn't sell very good. And I lived in a tent house, and I went around and painted by hand, painted barns for $1 an hour.
You lived in a tent house. Now, were you
tenant
married?
House. In a tenant house.
Oh, a tenant house.
Yeah,
oh. Yeah. And you were married and had the kids then?
4 kids, yeah. I had to survive. We did get, I think we got $35 a week unemployment. There's no such thing as sub, you know. You just didn't have it. You had to survive what you had.
Now, you had co-workers, and you developed friendships after working in the same area for a long period of time. Did you consider your co-workers brothers and sisters, or did it come to a time where you...
Yeah, there was some of them, yeah. Yeah, some of them would I'd stop over their place, you know, and we'd have a beer or something. We never really run around together too much, other than one couple we did a lot. We still had one couple we had placed down in Florida with him in the same park that he died not too long ago. In our park down there, we had four people from Fisher Body retired, and it's only a 21 place, 21 units, and I'm the only one that's still alive. All the others died.
And you just returned home from your winter stay down there?
Yeah, 4 months.
Well, welcome back.
Just outside of Orlando, where I done Highway 27, right in the middle of the state, south of I-4.
Cheryl McQuaid.
Sir, when you first hired in, when were you introduced to your UAW committee person? Were they out on the floor walking around introducing themselves? How did you become familiar with the UAW?
I'm thinking, maybe I'm wrong, I'm thinking they wore a button. They had to wear some kind of button indicating that there was no benefit reps or nothing. You know, they're just a district committee man, alternate committee man, and a top committee man. They wore a button indicating what they were. Because I've got some of them at home yet, I think.
And
they didn't actually introduce themselves, you know, more or less. And I managed to hold them up to introduce them neither, you know. They let you know you had union representation, but that was it.
Do you remember the first time you needed to use your union representation?
No, I don't, to tell you the truth. I know I did many a time.
How long did you stay in the soldering booth, the lead booth?
Off and on, 30.1 years.
Really?
Subtracting all the time I was president of the local. I was working in the booth when I retired. Never advanced out of the booth. As far as working on a job. You know.
You liked the job? You never put in transfers?
Well,
or?
I was normally, thanks to the people in my area who voted for me, I was either a district alternate committee man, a district committee man, a shop committee man, or a zone committee man, or the president of local, so I be thankful for the union that I spent majority of my time was union activities. You know, I mean, it was in the floor in there. I see a lot of stuff on the floor as a district committee man. Some good and some bad. I was under some committee, a top committee man that were terrific people, and there was some that weren't worth a damn. You know? Which I imagine that happens anytime, you know.
Would you please tell us a little bit about how you got involved with the union? You said they didn't approach you.
Have you interviewed Lloyd Kane yet?
No, we haven't got Lloyd yet.
Okay. He's why I got involved.
Well, tell us about that.
Well, I'm getting ahead of myself. He's the one that got me involved as far as being president local. You want me to go back to the other alternate committee man district before?
All right. What made you want to be an alternate or a committee man?
I just felt it was something, you know, that looked interesting to me, and then I felt people needed representation, you know, somebody to talk for them. I can't remember who the guy was that I run against. I didn't think he was doing the job, so I just run one.
Okay, now.
Many a time when we'd have a committee man in the front of the body shop, one in the back. When they'd have a cutback, then they'd go by seniority, and one of them committee men, you might lose your job for 3 or 4 months or a year or something, and then you'd have to go back to work on your job. District committee man.
And you served as a...
And you had to go back into work. You didn't have a call. You was in there wearing a hood. You better have that foreman better, you know, that took the calls. You'd have names on the people. You better have a legitimate reason to get out there and take that call. And 10 or 8 hours, your butt's right back on the line for the next 2.5 hours if they go 10 and a half hours. There's no hanging out in the work center and stuff. You know what I'm talking about.
Oh, yeah. I do know what you're saying here.
And they would make damn sure, you know. The management wasn't easy with the union at all. It was hard fought, everything we had to do.
So you felt the people needed a voice. You ran, thought you could do a better job, and you got elected, and you moved up to committee man. Did you consider shop chair? And then what made you run for president?
Well, I got appointed as a shop committee man for the night shift. You know, the other committee man appointed one of the districts as a shop committee man, and I was part-time shop committee man, you know. Not where I could serve on the executive board or nothing, but I was shop committee man there. And then I was that, and then I was trustee of the local at the time. 19. I was talking to my wife about this too. 1966. I was trustee of the local, and Lloyd Crane talked me into, or 65, he talked me to run for vice president with him. I said, Lloyd, are you gonna, because there was an opening coming up on the staff. I said, you're going to be around here, ain't you? You ain't going to be going down the staff and stuff and dump this on me, because I just got this farm where I'm at now, and I was farming it too, you know, and I didn't want a job that would tie me up a lot. He said, oh, yeah, I'll finish up the one term. Well, he was, if you look on your wall out here, you see his office, I think, 6 months. And he dumped the presidency on me. And he called me, and he had to call me into the union hall to convince me to take the presidencies, because I was about ready to drop out of it altogether then. So then I went on to become president.
And I do look at that picture up there, and I see you were elected three times after that.
Four times. Joe Santoro running against me. Harold Regglesworth, a guy by the name of Charlie Harper, who still works at Fisher Body. He's got a place out here in Eagle, selling cars and stuff. And Branch L. Ryan, who died not too long ago. So, was an ex-foreman or ex-supervisor one time.
So Lloyd left you that, and...
I've told him about that many times.
You still speak to Lloyd?
I think of it. Yeah.
But you must...
We had some terrific international union rep. I don't know what the caliber of them today, but I know for a while we didn't have the best around. But we had a John Haruska from 652. He was a fighter for the people in the plant. I mean, he would get right down there nose to nose for you to do anything. And Jim Ramey, who's still active in the Democrat Party and stuff, he was a tremendous guy. I really like both of them. I think they're terrific people, even though they're from another local, 652. I don't think you could beat them. In fact, I seen him the other day, Jim Ramey on TV, running Walmart down. Terrific, you know. Yeah.
Still fighting for the working man.
And the Democrat Party. There's anybody more dedicated than he was.
Can you share with us, as we go back inside the plant, you know, on a regular day, what did you do for lunch? You said you rode in with people. Did you guys do lunch together?
We brown bagged it, you know, put a paper sack. Then you could go to the cafeteria if you wanted to get sick later on or something, you know. Most people didn't want to really go there.
The food wasn't that good if you wanted to get sick later on. That's pretty good.
Where was it located? The cafeteria?
It was up on, at first it was in the ground floor. It was on the ground floor for a while. Then they moved upstairs there. They had to go up that escalator there by the body shop offices right up here. There were some people that I'm sure that used to get away with a lot of stuff. The guys on the line, some of them would cover up for another guy's job. Either would be up there playing cards maybe sometimes, or over to Harry's, taking a double lunch hour. You know, if you go out with body shop, come back to trim. That was a common thing in some areas, especially if you have a supervisor who go along with it. I never could do it, being the union guy, you know. But I knew guys that did it. because that was their pets, you know.
Well, you just
we called them brown nosers, or I don't know what you call them nowadays, but we call them different things.
You just shared about extended lunches. There's a place across the street that's from the Fisher Body Plant. It's been there ever since it was Duran Motor Works. It was called Harry's.
Yeah.
Can you tell about Harry's place? Did you ever go there, and what went on there? And talk about that a minute.
You ever go there, Doug?
Absolutely.
Yeah, I went there a different time. Usually I went there, not when I was working too much. I went over there at different times when I was president of the union stuff. Or chairman of the shop committee would go over there. You know, sit around table, talk stuff with the guys and have a few beers. They'd have good hamburgers. They used to have good hamburgers over there, good food. I think the guy's name was Gus. Am I right? Is that the guy that used to run it? One of them?
Gus was one of them, yeah. Yeah.
He was a real nice guy. Then a lot of times we would go down to Irish Pub. We hung out down there a lot. Okay. But I never went over there when I was working on the line very seldom. In fact, I didn't believe in it, you know, going over there and taking double in charge. It's just, I didn't think you should do that. Now, from not acting like a management guy, but I just didn't think it was right that you should be doing that.
Wanted to provide for your family, so there's no reason to get caught doing something where you could jeopardize that.
Oh, there was a lot of things that people used to do to get jeopardized for stealing. I run into that a lot when I was chairman of the shop committee or president of local. I had many a person come up here over the union hall, break down and cry because they'd lost their job. Wanted it back, and sometimes they'd bring their wives with them or kids. And or make you cry to have to give them the good news or bad news, you know, whichever it happened to be. It was rough.
Can you remember a particular, not necessarily name, but can you remember a time where you helped someone that stands out in your mind?
Yeah. I helped a lot of them. An awful lot of them in 1970 during the strike, which was, I mean, 90-some days we had. That one guy, I can say his name because he's passed away now. I don't think he would care. Gus Galanitis is his name. He worked in, he lived on East Grand River about 5-6 miles from me. I didn't know him real good, but he was from Lithuania. And he had hard life and stuff. And so it kind of, he was in the sanitation department, driving one of the sweepers around, you know. Do you know him?
Yeah.
Remember? Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, you know. And he'd been there, I think he had just a little over 30 years. And I knew he had a little problem. He was a little light-fingered, you know. And he was a terrific guy for selling you pop on the night shift, third shift. He'd bring in a case. He'd go to the Horrocks Market out here in Saginaw. He'd buy pop at a real cheap price and bring it in and sell to the cans of pop, you know, to the guys on the line. Then they'd take the empties back. In a big plastic bag, huge plastic bag. And one night, for some reason, I think they knew what was going on, but for some reason, somebody either ratted on him or plant protection, or somebody wanted to turn him in. They stopped him at the gate and made him open the bag up. In the center of the bag were the police in there, couldn't see, you know, guards. It was a big air motor come out of the paint department. So they immediately held him up there. Then they went out and searched his home, and he had quite a few different things out there. So they fired him right on the spot, you know. And we couldn't get his job back, but we finally got management. I wasn't chairman then. I think Bob Sanders was chairman then. But they got management to agree to let him have his full retirement, which meant a hell of a lot to him. You know, although he's passed away now at an early age, he enjoyed quite a few years of early retirement. He always bragged the union up too. He was kind of a funny talker. He was an alcoholic to start out with, but he took the cure, went through it. Turned out to be a hell of a good guy. He had a brother, Bill Galanitis, who worked up in
where was it? Material Control, I think. He's still alive. He's still alive. In fact, he used to, him and Gus and Bill used to, we all felt sorry for him. So my wife and I, when you go to the fishery reunion, they got a place down in East Bay in Florida, about 100 miles away, about 40 miles from Bradenton. We'd go around there and we'd pick these two guys up. Because we felt sorry for them, you know, that they kind of was underprivileged people, you know, over the year. We'd take them to that picnic. They enjoyed that. I never get a kid. We'd all have furniture, own meat and stuff, or food there, you know. Not, we'd bring meat for additional. I think the union paid for part of the meat and stuff. Bill and Gus would buy Kentucky Fried Chicken. You know, real fresh chicken, a bucket of. And then when we got to the where the meeting was, they'd have you open the trunk up, and they had a little cooler deal. They'd take half of that out, put it in the cooler for themselves for later on. I'll never forget that. They always did that. You know, them little things you don't forget, but where I laid screwdriver down yesterday, I don't know where it is, you know.
Yeah. So, what was the worst thing that ever happened under your presidency that you can remember?
I think a 1970 strike. That was terrible. We had people, I can't quote their names, from the International Union, kind of wanted to make you go right by the book. You know, if they didn't come in and perform their duty, it was over the strike committee, you know, and the funds and stuff, and they wouldn't get no check. And naturally, you know, we kind of reviewed every case where they had hardships and stuff. We tried to cover for everybody, 100%. You know, because we figured, hey, we were paying in the International Union Strike Fund all the time. Why shouldn't all of them get it? And it was kind of a constant fight with the, and even some of the people in the run, not community service, whatever they call it here in Lansing now. Nolan Owen was head of it one time. He was a fairly good guy, but this guy ahead of him wasn't too good. They were kind of, when you refer people over there for help, you know, we didn't feel they'd give them a fair shake and stuff. It all seemed to be like 652 got whatever they wanted, and we'd get what was left, if it's any, or wheat and the chaff, you know, on them deals. That's why we always felt anyway. I did as a union.
Did you ever have any battles with the International on the, as far as trying to do the best job for your
members? Well, we had to, 30 and out, we had to fight for that. We had to speak at the conventions for her, you know, when they had our different conventions. And, well, first we had to get it started out of Flint, Jack Wagner. I don't know if any of you remember him. He was a guy that was running against Don Ellis for regional director, who used to, I think he's passed away now, Don Ellis. But Jack kind of stirred it up on 30 and out. He was what they called a rabble rouser. Come out of 599, I think it is, Flint. The Buick local, anyway.
Right.
And he kept stirring us up at different conventions we had stuff. And finally, they got enough pressure on the International Union to start down the 30 and out. We got buttons, we had everything, got it all organized. And they got it in negotiation. That's one reason. When I retired, I said I was going to practice what I preach. I had 30.1 years and I left. Physically, mentally, I could have stayed for another 10 years, but I didn't believe it should do. I had a lot of other union officers stayed right there. Some of them stayed 40, 50 years.
Well, it's a major concern for us in the upcoming negotiations is whether or not they're going to try to go after that 30 and out. So I appreciate all you did to establish it, and hopefully we can retain it.
Well, you guys got a rough job ahead of you. I feel for you because it isn't the union's fault. It isn't totally management's fault. All you got to do is go right down to Washington, D.C., and you find out whose fault it is. Like with the gas prices right nowadays, it's just terrible. You know, and the prices of them go up, but if you're a retired guy, or if you're just drawing a 40-hour check, and maybe had to take a $5 pay cut, which Delphi, I guess they're going to try to get them to do, and there's not news coming in that they,
One international union, I guess, walked out the electrical workers or something. I heard that today. It's rough. And there's a lot of people, like you say, you know, earlier there, they got resentment against the union. They think the unions give way too much. But hey, the union had to do a lot of this to even have anything, survive. And you can point, in my opinion, you can point all the way back when Ronald Reagan was president with the air controllers. That started the whole damn thing. They walked out. What did he do? Fired them all and hired all scabs.
Yep.
That's why they, and that trick, and he had that old trickle-down effect, yeah. But yet, I watched a TV show the other day, and they had four presidents on there. They had Abraham Lincoln, Ronald Reagan, Jack Kennedy, and FDR. And who do you think was the most popular president of them? This gal was a contestant. She figured FDR, and I did too. Ronald Reagan was the most popular president because he was a movie star and all that horseshit.
A little TV exposure. Well, I'm going to lead you back to a little...
I'm getting carried away with you, probably.
That's all right. Lansing Fisher Body was recognized as the capital of quality, not only around the country, but all around the world. What do you think was the key to that?
Well, their workforce is the main thing. You know, they had good workers, there's no doubt about it. You had a field that were didn't want to come to work, maybe, you know. But the union negotiated the relief agreement, and extra board, et cetera, you know, and covered things for jobs. And I think that helps a lot, but mostly your workforce. And as time progressed, I think you had a little bit better management, too, than what used to be.
You drove up today. I don't know, had you seen it before, but the place is coming down now. The machines are out there, and you want a brick.
Yeah.
Tell me, what's it feel like after having put your 30 years in and to see it this way now?
Rough, really. Because I used to, when I was a shop committee man and top committee man, naturally you got to work anytime anybody's in the plant when you're, especially top committee man, chairman, you know. And you used to go out on 3X out there where you could work, look up the floor there and see the horse section where they're playing football and all that. And I was there when the whole front of the plant was all tore out and the whole brand new front was put in. In fact, I got pictures of that, and if I find it, I'll bring them in to you, you know. It was, and the fact that it's gone is just, you can't really believe it, you know. When you got a badge, I got a badge at home. No one was hired in that little badge. And a union card, yeah, I still got my union card. Makes you put in her cry sometimes, you know. And I keep trying to tell some of the younger ones, well, like my son-in-law, hired in 81. You might better start looking around. I said, hey, when that stock market from GM goes down, when I was there, and I had stock in General Motors, and I retired, and I kind of was done buying and needed some money because we just bought a, I didn't want to do it, but my wife wanted to buy a cottage up to Crystal Lake. And you imagine buying one when you drop $50,000 a year. I was making then, because I was working all kinds of hours, you know, down to 25. But we bought it. That I never thought I could swing, you know, what we did.
So you've enjoyed your retirement. Well, we've asked a lot of things. Is there anything we've missed today that you'd like to share? And what do you want to tell young people?
Well, I think a lot of it. The 1970 strike, I think, when I was lucky enough to be president of local, although sometimes it used to bother me a lot because I seen a lot of things that people sacrificed for. You know, lost a lot of money, but they got a lot of benefits for the people back in. You know, we had to set the pattern, then GM was a target. And usually the union don't like to take on GM very often because it's awful costly when they take on GM for a strike, and they try to, I'm sure, keep away from them, but that time they did, and I thought they gained a tremendous lot of stuff. And it's bad we have to start losing some of that, but at the same time, you got to be able to at least have some workforce, because the total amount of what I've read in the newspapers and stuff and heard, total amount of people unionized is going down tremendously. And then you got a spinoff here of other unions that got out of the mainstream, the Teamsters and three or four others, are forming their other little agreement, going to, I understand, put out a big notice indicating how these millionaire billionaires are getting paid off, you know, which is, I think, good. And I think the UAW ought to be pushing that issue more, the big, and the Democrat Party, too, instead of sometimes sitting idly by. When I happened to watch this morning when Bush was talking to on TV, not that I like to watch Bush because I hate the guy to watch. He's just sarcastic SOB to me. But Reed, who's the head of the Democrat Party there, and Bush is talking about the price of gas and stuff. What's Reed doing? Nodding his damn head. Yes. You know, more or less agreeing. I know he's set by the president, but why don't he just sit there, not say, not, you know, not nod your head at least, because to me, it makes me think that he's kind of going along with him in the background. And I don't see him out there talking too much against, some of them are now starting to, you know. You got Senator Kennedy, Ted Kennedy, and the Kennedys, to me, was the only thing ever was. I worshipped him. I remember going home afterward crying when the day he died, he got shot. I seen him at conventions, President Kennedy, and I seen Bobby Kennedy, Ted Kennedy, they all addressed the conventions. But I think, getting back to what you think of me, that I had one of the most best things I ever seen was Walter Reuther. That was when they started Black Lake up there. And we was one of the first bunch that went up there. And we went in there at the Black Lake Educational Center. I was president local then. John Lewis, the financial secretary. We went in there, and the first thing they did, they made us all put on hard hats. And Walter walked around with Emil Macy, who was financial secretary then. Of course, they had Macy's Bar. I don't know if that's still there yet.
Yep.
Is it?
Yep.
And we got to visit that. But we was just amazed, the union presidents, at the way that was designed. There's, number one, no paint then. No paint nowhere. And they had, everything was built around the trees. You know, everything was built around the trees. We were right there when they were still finishing the buildings yet. And that, to me, really impressed me, and I thought the world of Walter Reuther. And I also thought the government used, it was unfair when they went after his brother, Victor Reuther, you know, for years. And then when Walter and May Reuther got killed in a plane crash, that bothered me a lot, too. I got, you know, I ate dinners, you know, in the same area with them different times. And there's never another leader like Walter Reuther. I would think the closest one to him was Leonard Woodcock. Some of them that was leaders, Owen Beaver, I didn't have too much use for him. I thought he was a company man. Am I speaking on their turn?
But no, that, you're welcome to say anything.
Some of them higher-ups I didn't feel took the average worker's point of view too strong. And I did, and one other thing we did get to do when I was shop chairman, what I thought was quite interesting. We had one guy on the shop committee named Ralph Best. He knew Ken Bidwell was plant manager at that time. He had a place out in Arizona.
Region 20.
Okay. Keep going.
He had a place out in Arizona, and he wanted us to go to play golf with the plant manager because he knew him pretty well, you know. We went up to his house, and thank God he wasn't there that day because most of us didn't want to go play golf with the plant manager, you know, being union official. But there's always another side thing, you know. But we enjoyed that. The union really made me farm boy, I'm talking about, you know. Come from a Republican family. My dad was drain commissioner in the county for, and never started drawing a Social Security check till he was 72 years old. Maybe look at a different point of view because I got lucky enough, I always kept track, I got enough time in there, I went to 21 different states, you know, as flying all over the country, you know. And one thing Walter Reuther never take you, you never go to Florida. No way, because that was where the head of the AFL-CIO was at. And they was, I think it was George Meany, if I'm not mistaken. I think he was the head of it. And they lived lavishly down there, you know. And Walter said, you guys ain't going to do that. We went to other places. Chicago. We got to go to San Francisco, L.A., Pittsburgh, Philadelphia, Cleveland. A lot of stories about them places. A lot of tickets. Some of them he paid for yet. I remember making a U-turn in Philadelphia. Wife said I couldn't. Shop chairman, Bob Sanders, his wife, I made a U-turn. I wasn't supposed to make a U-turn. They wrote me out a ticket. Told me I had a Michigan place on them. I had to pay it within some time. I didn't pay it, and I ain't paid it yet. But I talked to the guy down in where the park I'm at from Pennsylvania. He says, if you ever get stopped in Pennsylvania again, you pay it. Because it'll be on your record. You pay the interest, probably. That's just a side note, you know.
Well, you've put a lot of years in, and we definitely appreciate your interview and all you've done for the labor movement and taking the time. We just got back from your vacation or your winter home, and we appreciate you coming on in and hope to see you at the Christmas parties and the picnics and continue to be active and supporting us, and we'll continue to do our part.
I don't know if Dorothy would want me at it.
Sure she does. Thank you, sir.
It's been a lot of fun. For the union, union can never do it any more than it has for me. You know, it's just been tremendous. I owe everything to them. What I got now, most of it, I got a cottage at Crystal Lake. I got putting her new motor home, or a mobile home, I mean, in Florida. And I got 140 acres of land, and I still farm 40 acres of a combine, my corn with a two-row combine, the only one in Ionia County. I rent out most of it, but I raise sheep, got a bunch of sheep around there, enjoy it.
Well, it's definitely been a
pleasure. Last year when I came back from Florida, I had a pacemaker put in me twice. So now, hopefully, things straighten out.
Well, you keep ticking, and we'll keep working for you.
I didn't mean to hold you up all this time.
Oh, no, we've enjoyed it. Thank you.
Thank you.
Appreciate you giving us the time.
I enjoy letting it out.
Oh, it's great to have you.